You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 29th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at University of Illinois, Chicago, Adam Goodman, on the deportation machine, America's long history of expelling immigrants. Also on the program today, SCOTUS rulings come down, big ones, as John Roberts signals he's very, very worried about court packing. Meanwhile, Houston, we've got a problem. Had to do it, folks. The city stops releasing ICU data as the Republicans plan to hold its in-person, no-mask convention in weeks. Florida, South Carolina, Nevada, all with new record infections. Texas pulling back. Mike Pence. Mask on time. Federal Elections Commission is now officially defunct as one of its Republican members leaves for Coke money. Betsy DeVos sends COVID relief money from public schools to private ones as Trump vetoes a loan forgiveness bill. The Massachusetts court strikes back at least for some of those who were defrauded by the for-profit college industry. Democrats seem primed to sink the filibuster if they take the Senate. Intel agencies claim Russia paid bounties to Afghan militants to kill U.S. soldiers. And a big Colorado primary tomorrow. Andrew Romanoff versus Hickenlooper, a big one, important. And tomorrow, Oklahoma will vote on whether it will expand Medicaid for thousands of people in their state in the midst of a pandemic. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. I hope you had a pleasant weekend. My voice again. I don't even think this was from yelling at my kids this time. My voice is starting to get to get a little tired. And not coincidentally, we will be taking a vacation next week to celebrate the independence of our nation. And, you know, maybe also as a eulogy for it. So I don't know. We'll decide what we're going to do. But we're going to be, we'll have all new content, great interviews, that I've been, doing over the past week or two, doubling up. So, we will have stuff for you, but, make sure you check it out. Also, my understanding is that the I'm Losing It Bro limited edition John Benjamin inspired
I'm losing it, bro.
T-shirts are selling like hotcakes over at shop.majorityreportradio.com. Not sure why we did this.
I'm losing it, bro.
But all the proceeds go to skidrow.org. It is a organization that supports the unhoused in L.A., and all proceeds, I mean, of course, Benjamin gets his cut. That's not true. That's maybe where we should have gone with that. See if we can get him, see if we can get him canceled. But check that out. And of course, just a reminder, this program relies on you for its support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we give you extra content every day. We also give you the show commercial free, and you just, you're making the show possible. That's just the bottom line. If you're one of those folks who are going through some financial troubles right now, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Give us, have some patience. We're behind on this. We've had a lot of requests, obviously, because a lot of people lost their jobs. People are starting to get concerned about unemployment running out. So if you're one of those folks, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put in the subject line, you know, membership, and we will get there. Just give us a little time. But if you're one of those people who are not worried about your finances, supporting the show right now, a great thing to do for, well, for all of us. So be much appreciated. All right. With that said, let's check this out. What's going on right now with this coronavirus is just nuts. Arizona, Texas, Florida. I mean, it's absolutely nuts. And I really, honestly, we'll talk more about this later, but I have no idea what they're going to do about this convention in Houston, this Republican convention. And I will admit that I have like these mixed feelings. Of course, I don't want it to happen. First of all, because you're going to have all these people together, undoubtedly they're going to send it out around the country, right? I mean, they're not just coming from Houston, but they're coming in there. And on the other hand, like, I am really interested in seeing just how masked up they get there, and that they're going to reap what they've been sowing. It's just, you know, I mean, it would be interesting if they all caught it and it was severe in some of those cases. That's all I'll say. Is that was measured, right?
Yeah, oh, interesting is one way, yeah. Okay. What I would say.
All right. Let's play this clip of Mike Huckabee. He's on Fox and Friends with Steve Doocy. And, you know, look, folks, here's the thing. If I had wings, I could fly, but I don't. Mike Huckabee wants everyone to have, figuratively, wings.
Ultimately, the coronavirus will be the defining issue because for so many people, Governor, it's an existential threat.
Pause it for one second.
Now,
presumably they're talking about the election here. I just want to make something clear. If you looked at the numbers, I mean, certainly this has cratered, and certainly, I mean, Trump's support has cratered. The Republicans were in big trouble in February as well. I think what this has done is it's made the liabilities that Joe Biden has less relevant. But the Republicans were in trouble. Make no mistake about it. They're going to say, and this is the one unfortunate thing in the event that Donald Trump loses and in the event that the Republicans lose the Senate, they're going to say it was a function of coronavirus as opposed to a function of the Republicans. But that's what it is. Continue.
Well, I think it's a serious issue, but nobody's going to blame Donald Trump because a pandemic struck the entire world.
Yeah.
If the United States were the only place that had it and we mismanaged it completely and just pretended it wasn't serious, yeah, then I think you could blame him. But nobody can say this president didn't take it seriously. He was acting prior to even Dr. Fauci thinking how serious it was by restricting travel from China into here. He has listened to the medical experts. Nobody can say he didn't.
I wonder if he, in the midst of saying that, he realized that he had a problem. Like that he didn't practice that answer in any way. And he was like, well, look, if it was only in our country and nobody took it seriously, because I thought he was going to say, like, the fact that it was in other places and we didn't take it seriously, that's why no one's going to blame him. I mean, do they really think that, does Mike Huckabee really sit there and think that members of that audience will not see the videos and the ads that say, you know, it's a hoax, it's going to go away, it's a contained, et cetera, et cetera? I don't know. I guess when you're talking to like a Fox audience, you're talking to such a homogenous group of people who get their media from one place that maybe they think they can get away with that.
Yeah, they're servicing the hardcore idiots right now with that.
I mean, and really, sir.
Anybody who has any outside media like exposure that isn't Fox News or like Huckabee, they might see it a little bit.
I mean, how rigid would your algorithm have to be that you're watching YouTube and that doesn't come up at one point? Like him saying, you know, we got 12 cases, we're probably going to get zero, or it's the Democratic hoax or all that. Like, I mean, they still won't wear masks, for God's sakes. I guess they just started this weekend. But wow. And it's going to be a disaster there. We're still sort of like, I'm going to put this in quotes, fortunate in the sense that, you know, apparently like when they look at the average age right now, it's still like 36 or 37. But it's going to, at one point, it's going to migrate. And then there's going to be some real, potentially enormous amount of fatalities. Really just nuts. We're going to get to our guest in just a moment. First, let me tell you, ExpressVPN, it protects your privacy and security online. But this is so key right now, folks. It's going to be key going forward. I'm sorry. But you can also use ExpressVPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. Why is that important? Well, you've gone through your entire Netflix queue. You've watched every show that you ever contemplated watching. But you could use ExpressVPN to binge shows like Doctor Who on UK Netflix. All you got to do is fire up the ExpressVPN app. You change your location to the UK, you refresh Netflix, that's it. Bingo, bango. ExpressVPN hides your IP address, lets you control where you want the sites to think you're located. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. So just think about all the Netflix libraries you can go through. It's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. ExpressVPN is incredibly fast. You can easily stream in HD. It's compatible with all your favorite devices, your phone, your iPad, your computer. If you visit expressvpn.com/majority, you can get an extra 3 months free of ExpressVPN. 3 months for free, extra. Support the show, watch what you want, protect yourself with ExpressVPN at expressvpn.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Adam Goodman. He is a professor of history at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and has written The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. We'll be right back in just a moment.
We'll be right back.
Okay. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Assistant Professor of History of Latin American and Latino Studies at University of Illinois, Chicago, Adam Goodman, on the deportation machine, America's long history of expelling immigrants. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you basically provide a history of the what you call the deportation machine, the mechanism by which we deport far more people than I think is conventional wisdom or is officially recorded. And you describe that there are basically three primary mechanisms or functions of this machine: formal, voluntary, and self. Let's start with voluntary and self, because that is more those are phenomena that have existed for a longer period of time, I guess.
That's right. You know, one of the startling discoveries I made while researching this book during the past decade is that, you know, rather than an affect of the Trump era, as many people are paying attention now, the history of deportation and the deportation machine dates back to the late 19th century. And the United States has deported 57 million people since then, almost, you know, 85 to 90% by coercive means, as you mentioned, voluntary departures, which are euphemistically named, there's nothing voluntary about them at all, as well as self-deportation campaigns meant to scare people into leaving the country, supposedly on their own. But as I show in the book, it's in response to concerted efforts of government officials as well as ordinary citizens. And, you know, these occur without due process. They instill a tremendous amount of power and authority in low-level agents of the state, which I think these days we can all understand how and why that might be problematic, whether it's the police in our nation's cities or immigration agents on the border and in the interior of the country. And the deportation machine has always been based on this discretionary authority for low-level officials. Now, voluntary departures, unlike formal deportations, which we come to think of as by an immigration judge historically, these are the 400,000 deportations per year the Obama administration was carrying out. These are just a small sliver of the total, well, as I mentioned.
Adam, let me just interject or ask for just a moment. So when the conventional wisdom expresses how many deportations we have had in our history, is there even a number that they cite, or is it just simply like since 1980 or some other date? And when they give that number, what is that number? Is it just those official deportations that you're talking about?
That's right. So most people, I think, social scientists, journalists, and the public understand that it's within the last 20, 25 years that deportations have spiked. And there have been 8 million formal deportations throughout the last 150 years. Now, this, as I mentioned, pales in comparison to the voluntary departures, which number 48 million plus. So what my book does is shows that if we want to understand the history of deportation, its impact on immigrant communities and on the nation, then we need to be looking at these coercive means, these informal means that the machine is dependent on from the start.
All right. So let's talk about those informal means when did they basically, I mean, it's almost like they didn't, it's not so much that they started uniquely, but it's almost like they'd never ended, right? When we formalized other processes, that didn't get, there was still just a tremendous amount of discretion. It feels like that. But tell us about the development of those processes.
Of course. So before the federal immigration bureaucracy existed, before the federal government had control over immigration, and that was only in the 1890s that happened, people who were local and state officials, as well as just ordinary citizens, made their own rules and enforced their own laws to decide who could stay, who had to go. Sometimes this was done by law enforcement officials, but oftentimes it was done through self-deportation campaigns, through fear campaigns that relied on the media, through restrictive laws, through threats of violence, and sometimes very real deadly violence that people then leverage to encourage people to leave. And what happens is in the late 19th century, a bunch of activists, and I use that word consciously because they were pushing for anti-Chinese legislation in the West Coast, primarily in California and Washington Territory. They organized to drive the Chinese community, the Chinese laborers, out of the West Coast, who they saw as a threat culturally, economically, as well as a public health threat. And they tried to do so through violence and through coercive means. But they also tried to push the federal government to implement laws excluding the Chinese, which they succeeded in doing in 1882, which was then renewed many times after that. Now, one of the real surprising things that I found in the research was I thought that kind of that assertion of federal power over immigration would lead to less of the informal coercive means. But instead, those informal coercive means got baked into the machine itself, which continued to rely on them. Now it was just the federal authorities who exercised that power.
I want to just talk a little bit about like the impetus. And we talk about anti-immigrant sentiment at that time. What did the economic implications of these immigrants mean in terms of in the context of the Chinese, they're associated with the building of the railroad. Was there a sense that they were taking the labor opportunities away from folks who are already here? Just outline for me like what the economic argument was. I understand the xenophobic one, right? I mean, I would imagine the level of ignorance at that time was probably even higher than it is today, although it's hard to imagine certain times. But from an economic perspective, what was the argument in these campaigns that existed? You know, because now we hear like, well, we don't want undocumented immigrants to come in and get free schooling. We don't want undocumented immigrants to come here and be on the dole. We don't want undocumented immigrants to get health care. Well, none of this was provided by the government at that point anyways. So give us a sense of what the argument was at that time relative to it could be Chinese and Mexicans, of course.
So this is a good example of how things have not changed, perhaps, over time. You know, one of the things that I discovered as I dug a bit deeper into the research was there's a lot of continuity. You know, the groups the deportation machine targeted has changed over time, and the reasons have sometimes as well. But largely, it's the same justifications for why authorities and why people in this country, you know, targeted immigrants. And certainly the cultural, the racial, public health, those factors matter a great deal. I don't think we can separate those from the economic, but to get to your question, the economic threat as perceived by white working men, primarily, who organized actively against Chinese laborers, was that they were taking the jobs of white laborers. And many of these white laborers themselves were immigrants, Irish immigrants who had arrived maybe 10, 20, 30 years earlier before the Chinese, or perhaps even at the same time. And this is something that we see certainly since that period, that immigrants have always been used as scapegoats for economic woes and I think real economic pressures and even suffering. You know, I don't want to deny that. I think that that is very real. The difference is that immigrants are a convenient scapegoat rather than the actual cause, and targeting them might serve the interests of xenophobic racist politicians or of people on the local level that want to justify why they're facing these troubles and hardships, but it actually doesn't address the root cause of the problem.
All right, fair enough. And so so moving forward, you talk about this dynamic where when the federal government gets involved, you would have anticipated that there would be less discretion down the line, that there would be formal policies and some type of like a formalization of the process, but it's the opposite. How does that work?
So what happens is that the federal government is granted the power to formally deport people in the late 19th century, but they're not given the resources. Congress does not appropriate sufficient monies for federal immigration officials to carry out their actions. And I don't know if the nation would have stomached it either, perhaps. I mean, we could argue or debate that. But I think that the key factor was that federal officials did not have the ability to carry out the law as stated by the books, and that was their task. So they turned to other means. They got creative. They figured out ways to expand their power and influence and authority. And these came through informal deportations, through the voluntary departures, which I liken in the book to the plea bargains within the criminal justice system. You know, if a prosecutor threatens someone with 20 or 30 years in prison, perhaps they'll agree to a 4 or 5 year sentence, understanding the threat. Formal deportations, you know, were used in a similar way by authorities who leveraged them and the harsher consequences they carried to get people to leave voluntarily, even though, again, that was under the threat of coercion and forcible removal.
Was the threat always with official sanctions? In other words, was it, you know, we're going to put you into the system and you're going to go to court and you're going to get, you know, held? Or was it like, you got 3 days and we're going to come after you?
Well, I think it was a bit of both. And, you know, the former would be that, you know, more commonly they would be threatened with an indefinite period of detention. They would be threatened with perhaps multi-year, even lifetime bans on reentering the United States. And authorities knew how to wield that power to try to convince people to sign a document that forfeited any due process rights they had, you know, gave up the ability to fight their case, and then, you know, left the country. Now, that was something that I think we've seen for the last century has been used strategically to the point that it became very common for many immigrants to be deported multiple times within the same year and certainly within the same period of years, such that people had many experiences with immigration officials. And I think that although some scholars and others have described voluntary departures as, you know, not punitive, we need to recognize the impact, cumulative impact, that they had on both individuals and the role they played in creating these harmful stereotypes of Mexicans as prototypical illegal aliens.
Well, I want to get to that part, but the cost associated with that. But it feels like it was a little bit like there's a kabuki quality to this, right? Where it's like, if you leave now, you can come back in and we'll throw you out again. And then you can come back in and we'll throw you out again. And as long as we do that, it's like we're playing a game of tennis or something. And it's really just, this will keep us employed and it will give you, you know, you're not going to be, it's going to be a little bit of hardship. It's going to be, you know, you're not going to be able to make any plans. There's a lot of costs associated, but it's better than going to jail. And it's almost like there's this like self-licking ice cream cone that's created. What purpose did it serve from the perspective of the Border Patrol or whatever entity was basically making this tacit agreement with would-be deportees? And what value did that provide the federal government or the local government? Was it just simply like, from a political standpoint, I mean, like, if there's no official record of these people being voluntarily deported or self-deported, where does the value come in for this process?
It's a great question. And I think it's an important one as well to understand. I mean, the immigration bureaucracy has strategically used these inflated numbers, right? They're able to inflate the numbers by deporting people multiple times. And as you described, people return after expulsion, they're apprehended again. And that in turn allows the immigration bureaucracy to show how many apprehensions it's making, how many deportations it's executing. It's not documenting them in physical records, but they are checking off how many people they're apprehending and how many deportations they're carrying out. And then in turn, they could use that to say, number one, look at all the great work we're doing from their perspective. And number two, we need more money. We need more congressional appropriations. And so they justified it in that way, and they used it strategically to expand their power within the federal government. And this is something we see over the course of the 20th century. And I think that they're also just dealing with kind of the deck that they were dealt, and that Congress and perhaps the country never, you know, wanted to give them the resources necessary. But it also, in some way, the system did work for the immigration officers as well as for employers who depended on cheap exploitable labor, and in turn for consumers who didn't mind paying rock bottom prices.
So it was just like everybody was sort of participating on some level in some type of like fraud. And the biggest cost is just associated with the immigrant who is basically just like a pinball in this whole system.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, we should be careful here not to say that, you know, migrants were willingly participating in this. This was certainly not something that anyone engaged in voluntarily or that they wanted to be a part of. I mean, it's important to recognize, as I show in the book, that the threat of going to work each day. I mean, I talked to one man who I interviewed in Mexico, in Jalisco, in central western Mexico, and he described in the late 1970s, when he worked on a ranch in California, he would get up every morning, get dressed, and casually hide $20 on his body somewhere, knowing that there was a real possibility each and every day the Border Patrol would come, apprehend him, and deport him to Tijuana. And he wanted to have a little bit of money on him so that he could figure out a way to return to California. But, you know, that was something that he internalized and presented to me in a way that made it seem very normal. But I think there's also a real cost associated with that. And the fact that, you know, so many people, you know, lived that experience while their labor was both demanded and also recruited heavily by U.S. officials and employers. But then in turn, you know, they're the ones that, as you say, you know, bore the brunt of these harmful policies. And physically, psychologically, materially, you know, migrants have not been at the center of immigration policy throughout U.S. history. And I think, you know, that's something that we should change moving forward.
When we talk about these costs, I mean, these are just, we're talking about human costs to the well-being of these individuals who, from whom there's a tremendous amount of value being extracted.
That's correct. And I would also just say that these individuals oftentimes are long-term residents or U.S. citizens, people who are married to U.S. citizens, who have U.S. citizen children. It's important to break down any kind of false binary between us and them that we so often hear coming out of Washington.
And let's talk about the dynamic where there are so many more Mexicans who are deported relative to the number of undocumented immigrants in this country. Or, you know, and this is over time. I mean, to the extent that it continues now, but I mean, over time, this has been the case. What accounts for that? And what does your work show that, what does that mean? I mean, is it just simply a function of this self-licking ice cream cone? It's the easiest thing to do to generate numbers. Is there some other greater meaning to it?
Well, we have to think historically here. I mean, why were Mexicans invited to this country and recruited to come to this country as laborers in such large numbers? And if we think of the late 19th, early 20th century, we see a series of successive immigration laws that limited and more or less cut off labor migration from Asia as well as from Southern and Eastern Europe. So as those sources ended, employers turned more and more south toward Mexico. And there were exceptions put in place for migrants from the Western Hemisphere. So Mexican laborers, you know, came to be the go-to source, in part because of the geographic proximity. And I think we should recognize the historical relationship between the United States and Mexico and the fact that up until the middle of the 19th century, you know, a third of the United States was part of Mexico. So immigration officials targeted Mexicans disproportionately, in part because they were the main source of labor, in part because the policies never allowed them to regularize their status. They just invited them here as short-term laborers, guest worker program contracts of 6 months that they'd have to come back and forth. But that cumulative targeting of Mexicans and disproportionate targeting, such that Mexicans represent around maybe one half of the undocumented immigrant population in the United States, but around 90% of the deportations. And that, aside from kind of the individual costs or the community costs, I think has gone a long way to creating and solidifying stereotypes of Mexicans as illegal immigrants. And that, I think, is very harmful when we think about questions of membership, who is an American, who is not, what does it mean to be American?
And is that just me basically because it's like, okay, we've got these, you know, I don't know, these Irish guys who have overstayed their visas. They're here without documentation at this point. But to, informally kick them out of the country, it's going to be trickier on some level, right? Or is, I mean, what is it? Why is that? I mean, is it just, are Mexicans low hanging fruit because they're easier to exploit within the context of the way that our you know, the sort of the implicit, I don't know, the racism or the bias against them? I mean, what is it just because it's easy? We can just physically push them across the border and they're back home? Why is there that disparity?
I think part of it is the racist policies that have long dictated our immigration control. Part of it is the geographic proximity, as you mentioned, between the two countries. And, you know, I think that those two things combined, you know, go a long way to explaining why. But we should also recognize that, you know, there's been a long history of exclusion from the organized labor movement in this country as well. It's not really until the 1970s that that starts to change. And I have a couple chapters in the book that address this. But, you know, Mexican workers were brought here on these short-term contracts. They were, you know, not able to organize, and they were actively excluded from the labor movement, whereas other groups might have had some protections in place because of their union status. So it's, I think, those combination of factors, in addition to the fact that the country's always depended on and needed a steady supply of exploitable labor and Mexicans after the exclusionary immigration laws cut off other sources of labor from abroad, came to serve that role.
Can you talk about the, I want to sort of loop back around in the 70s, because there was a movement that culminated in a Supreme Court ruling that I wonder from your perspective, it's implicated with this latest one in terms of refugees. But before we get there, the number of Mexicans who are imprisoned or undocumented immigrants who are imprisoned in this country, and how that has risen. I mean, I seem to remember in the aughts, maybe like a report that some of these for-profit prison places were basically saying, look, we're having a little bit of a problem. Our local supply of prisoners is drying up. And so we're starting to reorient towards immigrants. And it certainly feels like that was a business plan that was executed. Talk to that element of this.
And this is a key part of understanding the contemporary deportation machine. And that's the increasing role that private corporations have come to play on immigration policy. And, you know, the book shows that private companies have always been involved and have profited from deportation and the misery of migrants. But it's really in the last, you know, 15, 20 years that they've played an outsized role, I'd say, in immigration detention. Companies like the Geo Group, CoreCivic, which used to be known as the Corrections Corporation of America, they've seen immigration detention expand as a part of their multi-billion dollar portfolios. And they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars lobbying, they've spent millions of dollars lobbying Washington and received hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. government contracts in return. So, you know, these are, you know, some key changes. You know, we have seen a punitive turn, you might say, to the deportation machine in the last quarter century. And the increasing number of people detained, the increasing length of detention has been a crucial part of that. But another key, I think, aspect of how and why deportation has become more punitive is that formal deportations, which are oftentimes preceded by long-term detention stays and carry harsher consequences than the voluntary removals, they have been streamlined over time. So there's a series of laws and policies that have made formal deportations resemble voluntary departures in the lack of due process they provide. So now people are facing more punitive realities and also fewer opportunities to fight for the right to stay.
So there was in 19, I guess it was like a shoe factory in the near Los Angeles. And and they were they basically said when I guess it was I don't know if it was ICE at that time, but when
the Immigration and Naturalization Service
INS shows up, they refuse to answer their questions, right? Without I guess without a warrant or what? Tell us about that, and then I want to talk about the recent court case about rights afforded to would-be refugees.
Now, people have constantly fought against the deportation machine, and I'm able to trace this history, and I really bring it out in the 1970s, especially in this particular case you're describing about a shoe factory in South El Monte in the San Gabriel Valley in suburban Los Angeles. And in May 17th, 1978, a group of 40 immigration officials descends upon the shoe factory, surrounds it, closes off all the exits, goes through the factory indiscriminately questioning everyone who looked undocumented or illegal. In other words, all of the primarily Mexican and few Central American employees of the 700 people that worked there. They returned that morning to downtown Los Angeles with 119 people in custody. And by 4 or 5 o'clock that afternoon, just 8 hours later, half of those people were already headed to the Mexican border for expulsion on INS buses. But the buses never made it to the border that day. And what the chapter does is it traces the history of this incredible fight, this organizing struggle, because what happened, to the surprise of everyone involved, was that behind the scenes, right after the raid occurred, a group of labor organizers, activists, lawyers, and the migrants themselves, as well as some ordinary citizens, mobilized. They filed an injunction with a federal judge who signed it and blocked the deportation. They ended up fighting their cases, and the majority of those people ended up winning. And that identified a weak spot in the deportation machine, which is something that I think people are still doing today, of course, trying to figure out where the vulnerable spots are and then apply pressure to them. And they were able to win the right to stay. In addition to, over a longer term, through a class action suit, ensure that immigration officials provided migrants with basic Miranda type rights about the right to a lawyer and to legal aid, the right to remain silent. And these didn't stick over time, but it scared the immigration bureaucracy to no end. You know, they were incredibly frightened that more and more people might start rejecting voluntary departure, might start fighting their cases, which would have brought the deportation machine to a grinding halt. And I think that that's an important reminder.
Now, where are we with that strategy or tactic today? Because it feels to me like there has been a lot more resources put into formalizing that process. And there's been a lot more latitude for the detention, the imprisonment, the punitive things to take place without having to really go through as many steps.
That's correct. You know, I think that one of the things I also found in the research is that the vulnerable spots or the weak points in the deportation machine are constantly changing over time, as are migrant strategies and organizer strategies about how to contest them. So today, the machine doesn't look like it did in the 1970s. And in fact, it doesn't look like it did 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, in some general sense, it's the same, but who's in the White House matters a great deal. And I think organizers in the immigrant community have been trying to strategize and figure out new ways to defend themselves and defend their communities. That can take a little while because it's always this give and take, this back and forth between immigration enforcement agency and the migrant community. So I don't think that they are the same today. But one thing that is similar is that more and more people today are deported through these streamlined, fast-track expulsions. And the recent Supreme Court ruling on last Thursday, Department of Homeland Security versus Thura Singham, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, it basically gave authorities the ability to deport people through the formal means and limited any judicial review or oversight for the vast majority, if not all of those cases. And the second thing that it did very consequentially was it limited the ability for people to exercise any due process rights if they are apprehended soon after crossing the border, soon after entering into the country. So these are, you know, real blows. I think a very consequential decision that will have far-reaching impact, and certainly, you know, not one that most people would see as, you know, beneficial for the migrant community or for the country or the, you know, process of due process and the rule of law, perhaps. But I do think that it perhaps we could say fits into this much longer history and falls right in line with the history of expedited expulsions and not providing people with the legal rights that, you know, we would hope everyone in this country would have.
Do you understand how they make that, how the court basically made that decision? I mean, you know, is it like the close proximity to the border and length of time? You need to like have some, I don't know, like if you're 700 miles away from the border and it's been, you know, 4 or 5 days, then all of a sudden, our constitution, we must adhere to our constitution. Like, I don't understand the rationale for this. I mean, I can take a guess.
Yeah, you, me, and probably most people. I think people who follow these issues closely, you know, legal scholars and immigration lawyers are still hashing out the specifics. You know, what I can say as well is that there have long been exceptions to the rule of law and to the constitutional rights of U.S. citizens, permanent residents, and, you know, people who are here out of status as well. The Border Patrol and immigration officials have long exercised extraordinary authority within 100 miles of any border. So if you draw a line around the entire continental United States and then go 100 mile inland from anywhere, immigration officials have power that we might not imagine them to have within that area. And I forget what the exact percentage is of the population of the country, but most of the major cities are located in those areas. And, you know, many of us are living under, you know, are living in parts of the country where immigration officials might exercise power that we don't imagine them to have. And I think that, you know, this is certainly something that, you know, builds on that history, but even takes it one step further.
All right. So, I mean, and I appreciate you're a historian, so this is maybe outside your portfolio, but I mean, do you think there is, I mean, what would it take to change this disposition that has created this machine over, you know, over 150 years now easily? Is this a permanent fixture? Is it something that we can diminish? Is it, would it even be better to formalize all this and have less discretion? I mean, what's the response to this reality that would make our system more humane?
That's a important question. And, you know, one of the realizations I had doing the research was that immigration enforcement, history of deportation, is not a partisan history where the Republicans are bad, the Democrats are good. I mean, I trace the bipartisan history of punitive policies that presidents and administrations from both parties have rolled out. And I end the book not necessarily on an optimistic note, saying that the deportation machine is going to continue regardless of what happens in November and now regardless of which party is in power. Now, I think recent events, perhaps related to, Black Lives Matter organizing and what we've seen across the country in terms of the push to abolish the police and defund the police, I think raises important questions about movements we've seen in this past year with organizers pushing to abolish ICE. And whether or not that happens, I think it should be on the table. I think that we should have, you know, a broad swath of options, some perhaps more far-reaching, idealistic, and utopian, and some that operate within the system as it is. But, you know, one thing I would say is that we could make immigration enforcement more of a service agency to the immigrant community and to the nation, as opposed to an enforcement agency. And those two things have always been in tension within the immigration bureaucracy. So if we shifted the resources and shifted the identity of the bureaucracy to more of a service organization as opposed to an enforcement organization, that would be a good place to start.
Adam Goodman, the book is The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. We will put a link to that book at majority.fm. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will talk about the crap show that is this administration and their attempts to mitigate the damage that they have done. Maybe their attempts are less about to the country, but more to their reputations and to the amount of blame that they're about to get for what they have wrought on other parts of the country. We'll also talk about, you know, this, you can't wish this virus away, folks. I don't know what else to say. We will also, we're going to touch on the Supreme Court rulings, but tomorrow we're going to go deeper into these. There is a, you know, this Louisiana case that was about a trap law. Trap being, I can't remember what it stands for, but essentially laws that are attempts to regulate the right to an abortion out of existence with regulations that are trivial. Trap law could be even trivial regulation. I don't remember what it stands for. But there was a case that took place. When was that case, Brendan? It's targeted regulations on abortion providers. And so we had a case that showed up in 2016. And you had basically a case that was very similar to this Louisiana case. It was about a case in Texas, and I can't remember exactly what the law was. I think it was something to the effect of like abortion providers needed to have a relationship with local hospitals in a way that no other doctors who provide this type of outpatient facilities do. And it was clearly a law that was passed to inhibit a woman's right to an abortion. That's what this Louisiana law was as well. And the idea that they had taken the case again in and of itself was silly because they had just dealt with this case 4 years ago. That seems to be at first blush what the ruling is like, we've already covered this. I think it's also John Roberts feeling the pressure of the increased talk about court reform in the wake of the whole Merrick Garland fiasco, in the wake of 200 judges being put on federal courts, multiple ones who have been deemed to be completely grotesquely unprepared and unqualified for these lifetime appointments. And I think he's nervous. And we also had a ruling on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. There was an attempt to sink that entire bureau based upon a aspect of the law that said that the president could not fire the head of the CFPB at will. He needed cause, or she needed cause. And the court found that it is the case that the president has the right to fire this person at any time, as opposed to for cause, anytime and for any reason. However, the concept of severability came up here, which is when a part of a law is challenged, is that part of the law so intrinsic and so important to the entire law that the entire law must be struck down? This dynamic came up quite a bit during the ACA Medicaid expansion or ACA essentially debates. If the mandate that you need to have insurance is struck down, then is the entire ACA, should that be struck down, or is it severable? Well, the court in this instance found that the provision that the president needed cause to fire the head of the CFPB was severable. So they just said that part we're going to change. The rest of the law stands. So now the president has the right to fire the head of the CFPB. Now, of course, the appointee is by Donald Trump. So really, this is going to mean that if Joe Biden wins, he's going to come in and be able to summarily fire this hack that is on the that agency as it is now. So, but we will talk to a SCOTUS expert on this. And there was also another case about NGOs being forced to certain provisions about not supporting sex work to get funding. We will talk to a Supreme Court expert on these questions, because I am just a 1-year law school student, so I'm not qualified for these things. All right. We're going to head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. As you know, I am turning the voicemail off. I am firing up the IMs. Just a reminder, again, this show relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Check out our merch at shop.majorityreportradio.com. You can pick up the I'm Losing It, Bro t-shirt. Oh, that's not it. I mean, that's how funny
I'm
it is.
Losing it, bro.
That is the John Benjamin signature t-shirt that all the proceeds go to skidrow.org, the Skid Row Trust in California, which services, I think, a couple thousand of unhoused folks in the LA area. So check that out. And just a reminder, TMBS tomorrow night. Matt, do you have any idea?
I'm not sure who we have this week, but last week we had William Shockey of Africa is a Country and Ronan Burtenshaw of the Tribune.
So check that out. You can find the Michael Brooks Show at patreon.com/TMBS. Or youtube.com/TMBS, the Michael Brooks Show there. Also, don't forget, Nomi Key's show, The Nomi Key Show, patreon.com/The Nomi Key Show. You can also find it at youtube.com/The Nomi Key Show, particularly in the wake of all those wins last week. Hopefully, we're going to know a couple of key counties, I think, in the next day or two about in Kentucky. So we may know, we have a much better sense. Some big, hopefully progressive wins. Don't forget tomorrow, Colorado, vote for Romanoff if you're in Colorado. Jamie.
Hello.
Back from your camping excursion.
I had a very chill, normal time in the countryside at an undisclosed location. No funny business.
I don't know if that's facetious or not.
Definitely did not train for any type of Antifa super soldier activities. Just good, wholesome fun with my best friend who turned 40 this last week. So happy birthday, Debbie.
Is that why you wanted all those human growth hormones before you went up there?
I don't know what you're talking about, Sam.
What's happening on the Antifada this week?
I'm so glad you asked. So this past week on the Antifada, we had on Scott Frazier from the very excellent LA podcast to talk about the corruption and the open white nationalism of the LA Sheriff's Department, as well as the hapless way that Mayor Garcetti has handled both homelessness in Los Angeles and the current rebellion for Black lives. Also, on Friday, I released a Vampire Castle with Leslie Lee from Struggle Session, where we talked about two very great coming-of-age vampire films, Let the Right One In and Byzantium, or Lady Bird 2, as I like to think of it. And this week, we are having on Nick Estes from Red Nation to talk about indigenous rights struggles, his book on Standing Rock, and how indigenous resistance is connected to the fight for Black liberation. So check it out, patreon.com/theantifada.
And Matt, I know you are not training this weekend either. What for an eventual overthrow of anything. What have you got planned for your Twitch stream?
I've been I'll be hitting the high seas of the North Atlantic again tonight in Assassin's Creed Rogue, and we will be learning more from Peter Linebaum, Marcus Rediker's The Many-Headed Hydra, Sailors, Slaves, Commoners, and the Hidden History of the Revolutionary Atlantic. So I'll probably be doing a longer stream tonight because for the first time in months, I'll be alone in my apartment.
Wow. Gaming night. You're going crazy.
Might be an 8-hour stream tonight. I don't know. We'll see.
I was just thinking, like, I don't understand how you are allowed to get away with this every night.
Barely.
Yeah.
I'm barely allowed to get away with it.
And then I was just thinking, like, it is probably like one of the nerdiest things you could possibly do every night. I mean, with all due respect. Except for, I will say this. Oh, he just disappeared. Shut off his camera. I will say this. My son, and I don't like it to spend this much time in front of a computer at all. In fact, I think it's a world record for him. Spent about 5 hours on Saturday watching the Brick World Lego Expo that had multiple. For like $9, I think it was. Like you go into multiple Zoom channels.
Oh, wow.
And like one was like Masters of Legos champions, and they would get instructed to do something and they would build it in a half hour. And then other like geeky little kids would show their stuff. And and like he watched like this great ball contraption, which is a subculture of the Lego culture.
Right.
Obviously. These are all adults. And,
Lego.
And actually, I got to say, the ball thing was incredible. They would have like hundreds of balls and people would make various like engineering contraptions. But it was all about like, I was able to get this piece that has the thing. And because they sold it in Japan 30 years ago, and I was able to track them down for like, you know, $1,500 or something to make the like, it was. So
sounds cool.
Yeah, actually it was sort of interesting, but it was a lot of geek nerd.
That's the future. Energy. We just have to geek through Zoom.
That. Yep. All right, folks, quick break, fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird.
No way!
Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.